good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO, your non-commercial community radio station located in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and that there, the regular People Rise Up theme, is from Hamza Leela. I want to mention that every once in a while. There's a link to their site on the People Rise Up page. This morning, I'm going to be talking about some history. Not only history, because the potential exists to considerably add to this book in the present. And I'm talking about a book recently released called 50 American Revolutions You're Not Supposed to Know, Reclaiming American Patriotism. It was written by Mickey Z. He is a self-educated writer and martial artist. He's been called a professional iconoclast on more than one occasion, and I like this. From his website, he says he likes sunsets, rainbows, and anarcho-syndicalism. Great combination. Doesn't like mean people, traffic, or factory farming. So it's my pleasure to welcome you, Mickey Z, to KBOO's airwaves.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here.
Now, this is the first I have ever heard of you. And I'm just curious if you could maybe give a little more context for how it is you came to write this book, 50 American Revolutions.
Well, I've been writing for many years, and this is actually my fifth book. But when you, as you well know, when you deal with radical topics, it's not easy to necessarily gain an audience. Mm-hmm. I do write for some radical websites that people might be familiar with, CNET, Counterpunch, and so on. Mm-hmm. But this particular book, I guess, is a result of me being out there writing, because it's the first time a publisher actually contacted me and said, hey, we have an idea for a book. Do you think it's something that you might be into? And I certainly said yes.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, it was shocking. That's how I sounded.
Okay, cool. So the publisher came up with the idea.
The general idea, yeah.
How were you approached about it, and what was it that made you go, yeah, I got time to do that?
Well, there was a book that was self-published in England not too long ago called The Little Pocket Book of Patriotism. And it was more traditional in the sense that it sort of offered a timeline of mainstream, traditional Great Britain history, and the book did surprisingly well. Well, the publisher said, well, what if we put together a book here in the U.S., but we'd put a different spin on it, and meaning that we present information in a timeline type of fashion that isn't necessarily common knowledge, that isn't necessarily in your history textbook, that might be left out of historical movies on similar topics. So when they contacted me and I bounced a few ideas by them of what I'd like to include, and they were totally in agreement, then I said, all right, this is something I could work on, because I wasn't interested in doing a book about U.S. history that was going to talk about, you know, man landing on the moon and the traditional points where people celebrate the United States of America. I wanted to talk about incidents and episodes and people who really were down and dirty doing the dirty work to win the freedoms and rights that we do enjoy.
Well, and that's a perfect match for these here airwaves, because our public affairs programming is supposed to, in part, cover things that are underrepresented or neglected in the public sphere.
There you go. I mean, and that's a tall order in a society as heavily conditioned as ours.
Well, so let's dive into some of the 50 herein. We're only going to obviously be able to get to a small portion of these, and hopefully you listening will go, wow, if that's what they were talking about, I can't even imagine what the other 40 are like. And I'm gonna somewhat go kind of chronologically and do my best to have some of those more obscure events discussed herein. So why don't we leap initially to the Seminole African Alliance?
Okay. This one kind of came out of an article written by historian William Lauren Katz, in which I had a moment when I read it where, wow, I didn't know that. And that's kind of the idea behind this book. You want people to be going through it, to be kind of taken aback by the information being presented. And I had one of those moments reading about how down what today is Florida, there was the Seminole, which was the Seminole Nation, which grew out of the Creek Nation in Florida. And this area became common where African slaves, when they would escape, would run to. And the escaped African slaves and the besieged Native Americans formed an alliance against the expansionist colonists, or however you wanted to call them, Americans, I guess. And it's something that, I've read a fair amount of history. I've never heard anything about it. And when you read more about it, how these groups united together, they knew the terrain, they were faced with overwhelming force, you begin to recognize these patterns that would then, throughout U.S. military interventions right up until today, the same patterns where the U.S. military goes in with overwhelming force and is met with essentially an indigenous guerrilla army that fights the type of war that they weren't expecting, and it kind of drags out into a long, ugly situation. And I found it to be inspiring because the Africans that lived with the Native Americans, they brought their methods of, say, rice cultivation from Sierra Leone and other points in Africa, and they taught the those indigenous to this continent these methods, and they began to coexist in a way that I don't think many, many people would even imagine and certainly wouldn't know about.
The only context that it's unfortunate, the only context in which I've ever heard much about the Seminole African Alliance is actually a song written by Chris Chandler.
Oh, what's the name of that?
It's called "I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, Florida." And in there, he references the Seminole African Alliance, and you know, he presents it in a funny way, but I mean, the alliance really did exist and happen. He references them as teaming up to invent menthol cigarettes, which, you know, obviously wasn't the case, but as with many things that he writes about in his music, there is fact behind it, and then he makes it weird.
Anyway. I mean, I guess any context for a story this obscure and, in my opinion, this important, it's good for it to be brought out in any way. And then hopefully people like yourself, if they heard that song, would then do a little bit of investigation themselves and find out that there's a lot more here. And it's something to take pride in the sense that these two ethnic groups that faced incredible, incredible hardship because of the white settlers on this continent teamed up. And I think it was a fascinating story.
I'm going to just read here from the last paragraph in this entry. Let me see here. I'm looking at this. Who is Katz that I'm quoting here?
That's William Lauren Katz. That's the historian.
Okay. He says, quote, "An estimated 380 to 480 freedom-fighting African and Indian members of the Seminole Nation threw back in advance of more than 1,000 U.S. Army and other troops led by Colonel Zachary Taylor, a future president of the United States. The Seminoles so badly mauled the invaders that Taylor ordered his soldiers to fall back, bury their dead, tend to the wounded, and ponder the largest single U.S. defeat in decades of Indian warfare." So, obviously, an extremely significant event. No country likes to talk about its defeats. So it's not entirely surprising that there's not a lot in the history books about this.
I agree.
Well, let's move along here a little bit, all the way to the next entry. The Lowell Mill organizing amongst, and it says girls, it's 18 to 22, so girls, women, however you want to put it.
Yeah, the only reason I use the term girls is because they're generally known as the Low Mill girls. It wasn't my judgment to call them girls, but it's a term that's familiar with this group of women, but they range even as young as 11 years old, which makes it even more amazing.
Right.
It was a tight-knit group of girls and women, and I'm talking about roughly 1850s Massachusetts, and they worked in the textile industries. And these women, as you said, ranging from 11 to perhaps 25, did something astonishing at this time. They marched, they demonstrated, they started a union, they started newspapers, they went on strike, and they essentially changed the role of women in the American labor movement forever. It was a powerful example of what anyone can do. And like the episode right before, it challenged a dangerous stereotype in terms of people's opinions of the Native Americans, people's opinions of African slaves, and in this case, people's opinions of women or girls as inferior to the white men that were running things, that these women were able to organize in such a manner in this time period, we talk about the 1850s, in such a way that inspired many, many other organizations and labor movements and so on.
Yeah, and it says here that the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association in 1844 was the first organization in the U.S. of American working women to bargain collectively for better conditions and higher pay. So again, you know, kind of a groundbreaking thing that, you know, is lost in history because it opposes the dominant paradigm.
And on many fronts, not just in terms of sexism, but of course in terms of capitalism, in the sense that it's more convenient for today's Americans to not fully recognize how hard and the sacrifices people made to work to get something like the 5-day work week or the 40-hour week, things that we take for granted, things that we are losing rapidly at this time period. And union, the word union has become synonymous with corruption and so on in modern America. And that doesn't mean, of course, it's run by human beings. Doesn't mean that some unions aren't better than others. But the entire union movement and the labor movement has been so badly damaged through propaganda and conditioning that a story like this, just it's almost impossible to believe when you first read it, when you're talking about the 1850s.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's really hard. I have no idea how to imagine what conditions would have been like for a very young woman in a textile mill in, you know, mid-19th century Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, the hardship that they encounter, because you hear this a lot, anybody that's trying to organize, anybody that's involved in activism, you hear people say, well, who has the time, and, oh, you know, this is too hard. I mean, the conditions under which other people from this country and elsewhere, of course, have organized under are something that I think we all should recognize at times, that how much easier many of us have it today and how much more time we have. And I've included again, it's Lowell Mill Girls, as they're called. I included them in precisely for that reason. I found them to be an inspiration and something that I believe people organizing today's movements can learn from.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. Mickey Z is my guest today. He's the author of 50 American Revolutions You're Not Supposed to Know, Reclaiming American Patriotism. And you can find out more about him online at www.mickeyz.net. That's MickeyZ.net. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has links to his site where you can find the book, and will soon have information related to the show up there. Before we dive back into some more of the book, I want to share a couple of quotes regarding patriotism that I pulled this morning. And there's no shortage of really good quotes about this, ranging from patriotism's a ridiculous, artificial idea that diverts attention from other things, even in a positive way, to, yeah, you know, progressives need to reclaim the concept of patriotism. So along those lines, Barbara Ehrenreich, who actually was on our airwaves yesterday, no matter that patriotism is too often the refuge of scoundrels, dissent, rebellion, and all-around hell-raising remain the true duty of patriots. Let's see. Theodore Roosevelt, back in 1918, to announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public. And then lastly, for a little bit of balance, Emma Goldman. Patriotism is a superstition artificially created and maintained through a network of lies and falsehoods, a superstition that robs man of his self-respect and dignity and increases his arrogance and conceit. I'm curious where you sort of fall in that range of, yeah, progressives, radicals need to reclaim the idea of, you know, dissent and patriotic action, or kind of more what Emma has to say there?
Well, I guess what it comes down to is how one defines the word patriotism. And as you know, words have very fluid definitions. In fact, if you want to go back to Emma Goldman's time, the word anarchy and the word propaganda were certainly viewed differently than they are today for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And the subtitle of this book, Reclaiming American Patriotism, is sort of a challenge to steal the word back from the flag wavers and give it a new meaning in the way that Ronald Reagan gave new meaning to the word peacekeeper when he decided to name a nuclear missile after it. Uh-huh. I mean, words have fluid definitions. I totally respect those who look at the traditional definitions of patriotism as this national chauvinism, as something to be reviled and challenged on all fronts. But I think that it's far too easy to just relinquish it to those who, you know, slap on the support the troops sticker on their SUV and consider themselves to be patriots. It's interesting that those people seem to be most offended when someone like myself actually exercises the freedom that they claim to adore. It's almost as if the best way to honor our freedom of speech here is to keep our mouths shut and to keep our criticisms to ourselves. And so I'm saying that we have freedoms and rights in this country. And, I mean, this conversation is proof of that. And I'm saying that it's important to, A, recognize that, and, B, reconsider those who have worked hard over the years of the United States existence to help win these rights. Because the only way you get these rights is through struggle and resistance. They're not going to be given to you. So if someone chooses to not like the word patriotism or not want to use that, it, at the end of the day, it's semantics. It's neither here nor there. The idea is not to surrender a word so easily to someone that's simply going to wave a flag, sing God Bless America, and consider themselves a patriot, because they're doing a dishonor to the people like those in this book who have worked hard and given their lives to win the freedoms that we enjoy in this country.
Yeah, and personally, I think our constitutionally guaranteed freedoms, the true test of them is kind of at their periphery, like how far, like where's the edge of the envelope, as it were. That's where the freedom lies. It's not in doing the same thing as everybody else. It's in the act of dissent that
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, that's the test.
Yeah, I mean, the standard perception of freedom of speech is it should pertain to freedom of speech is for those who say what you disagree with. And it isn't to tell people to shut up. And during a time period like we are going through right now, a real challenge is the concept of support the troops, meaning that if you criticize the war, somehow you're going to cause deaths. It's a situation where support the troops really means support the policies. And I think if we really want to do anybody a favor, we should inform the troops, and preferably before they sign up, and have some type of counter-recruitment to inform them of what's going on and what they're going into. And their country's history in military interventions. And I think that the providing that type of context is a role we all can play.
So Rosa Parks recently died, and there's been a lot of reflection upon her actions back in the 50s regarding the action she took to not get up because she was just darn tired after working a day and wouldn't yield her seat after. My understanding is that the section between the bus for black and white varied depending on how many people were on the bus. And so she was in the so-called black section, and I guess a bunch more white people got on and they moved where the barrier was. So she was no longer in the black section.
Sure.
And they just said, you got to move back. And she just said, uh-uh. But there's a big leap, like literally almost a century to the day even, before when Elizabeth Lizzie Jennings, a 24-year-old school teacher, tried to get onto a bus in New York City. And this is in, well, horse-drawn carriage. They didn't have buses then.
Yeah.
And as you note, and I'd never heard of this, this was in the day when, quote, drivers carried whips to keep undesirable passengers off. Tell us about Lizzie Jennings and how she risked being whipped to get on this carriage.
Well, we're talking about 1854 New York, and at that time period, that New York had the nation's largest African-American population, and those residents did pay taxes. Some of them owned property. But when it came to riding the bus with whites, well, that's where the whip came in. There was some buses, and I'm using the term bus for a horse-drawn carriage that was called a bus at the time. Some buses had a very large sign that said colored persons allowed. And those without that sign, obviously, anyone not wanting to get whipped wouldn't risk getting on there. And what was interesting, that the parallel between Lizzie Jennings and Rosa Parks is that neither one of them committed this random act of defiance. There might have been the moment they chose to do it might have been of their choosing and almost some sense of spontaneity. But both of them were part of movements for equality in their time and in their setting. And in Lizzie Jennings' case, she was involved with a church that was trying to get more equality here in New York City. And she made this decision to get on a bus, that one of the buses that didn't say colored persons allowed. And the bus conductor literally, physically, threw her from the bus, and she decided that enough was enough, that she was going to take legal action. And in kind of an odd quirk, she was represented by a lawyer named Chester A. Arthur, who would go on to become the 21st president. But she won the case, and it took place in Brooklyn, which was a separate city at the time. And I'll read the this is sort of in an 1855 sort of way how the judge declared her the winner. She said, he said, colored persons, if sober, well-behaved, and free from disease, had the same rights as others and could neither be excluded by any rules of the company, the bus company, nor by force or violence. And she ended up winning $500 in damage, of which she got much less than that. But one day after the verdict, the company, which was called the Third Avenue Railway Company, issued an order to admit all African Americans on all their buses. And by 1860, which is 5 years after this trial, all of New York City street and rail cars were desegregated.
Yeah, that's a totally great thing. We're running out of time here, and I'm only going to be able to talk about one more instance here with you. We're going to leap quite a ways forward to someone who I've heard her name in passing, but I knew nothing at all about her. And that's Betty Friedan, who was born in 1921, and as a result of there being no other date, I assume, she is still alive.
Yes.
Who's Betty Friedan, and why is she in here?
Betty Friedan, she is the author of a book called The Feminine Mystique, which came out in 1963. Now, looking back in hindsight, and the amount of progress made by feminist movements, it was a limited book in terms of what she was addressing. But at the time, and that's what I try and emphasize with this book, is to judge these episodes through the prism of their time. And in 1963, she asked basically a very simple question from the perspective of a suburban housewife, and that question was, is this all? And the book begins, and I'll just, she talked in the book, each suburban housewife deals with life in 20th century America, and she was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, is this all? Now, the book itself became a major catalyst in terms of inspiring at the time, the fledgling women's rights movements. Now, even though it focused almost exclusively on white middle-class women and didn't talk about radical solutions and so on, it can't be discounted in terms of its power at the time. And it started as she did like an impromptu survey asking at a high school reunion, asking her female friends where they were at and whether they were happy. And then she realized that it was time to turn this into a book. And she eventually founded the National Organization for Women, the National Women's Caucus, and the National Abortion Rights Action League. So, through looking at it through today's world, her critique almost appears obvious. But what's obvious today was almost revolutionary at the time.
Right. Well, and there's some other examples of that in the book that we're not going to really get a chance to talk about. Katharine Hepburn putting on pants.
Yeah, yeah.
It's strange to think that women wearing pants would have been some sort of revolutionary act given the context today, but
what's mundane today was radical many years ago.
Right, right. So just lastly here, and kind of briefly, after each entry, there's a short timeline included of some events kind of contemporary to the actual entry.
Yes.
Why did you do that, and how did you choose those?
Well, the short answer of why I did it was because the book was limited to 50 episodes, and I didn't want to give any impression in the world that these were the definitive 50 that I was presenting, the ultimate list, or that anyone should think that there were only 50 examples of radical ideas reaching the mainstream in American history. There are more than we could possibly list. So the idea in the book was to present the short little excerpt, the quote-unquote American Revolution, and then, as you said, offer anywhere from to 2 to 5 concurrent events that any one of them could have replaced any of the revolutions in there. And you know, as it is when you're writing a book, you have to make a decision and go with it. And who knows, maybe there'll be a sequel and we'll be able to squeeze some of these in there and give them a little bit more space.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mickey. I appreciate you not only writing the book, but being willing to talk about it here on KABU.
Well, I loved being here. I appreciate you giving me a chance to reach your audience. And I invite everybody again to come to my website, as you said, MickeyZ.net. And thanks so much.
Mickey Z is the author of 50 American Revolutions You're Not Supposed to Know, Reclaiming American Patriotism. Once again, thanks.
Thank you.
And off he is. And again, MickeyZ.net, MickeyZ.net. Thank you very much for listening. If you had any questions about today's show, any previous show, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send regular paper mail to me here at KABU, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm will have links to Mickey's website, the book, some patriotism-related history and quotations and such.